Ken, you say you never tire of introducing me. I think the audience can see why I never tire of having you do so. So this is the 25th anniversary. It's a long time, and it's a great organization. This crowd, this vast audience here tonight, composed of blind persons, great and small, and congressmen and senators, great and small. In fact, I wonder why Ken didn't begin by saying that this session of Congress is now in order this evening. I wish I had time before turning to my other tasks to greet all of our organizational friends and all of my personal friends who are here, both among the blind persons and others and the congressmen and senators. There are many that I would like to bestow special commendation upon. That, however, will fall to the lot of others, and I must get on to the task assigned to me. I want to say, however, that I haven't spoken to such a large audience since the fall of last year, and the occasion on which I spoke to a much larger audience was this. I was standing on a city-owned garbage can in the plaza at Berkeley, California, speaking to several thousand students while reading my Braille notes off of my son's head. I must say that that picture got all around the country, and quite a number of people wrote me to find out whether I was in jail yet. Oscar Wilde told us in one of his sentences that most modern calendars mar the sweet simplicity of our lives by reminding us that each day that passes is the anniversary of some perfectly uninteresting event. And so it is. This is caution enough to remind us that we must approach the task of celebration and review with some pause and some humility, neither exaggerating our importance nor underestimating it. It is my task, in this spirit, to capsulize our history, convey our purposes, and contemplate our future. The career of our movement has not been a tranquil one. It has grown to maturity the hard way. The external pressures have often been unremitting. We have been counseled by well-wishers that all would be well, and we have learned to resist. We have been attacked by agencies and administrators, and we have learned to fight back. We have been scolded by guardians and caretakers, and we've learned to talk back. We have cut our eye teeth on legal and political struggle, sharpened our wits through countless debates, broadened our minds and deepened our voices by incessant contest. Most important of all, however, we have never stopped moving, never stopped battling, never stopped marching towards our goals of security, equality, and opportunity for all the nations blind. It's fitting that the anniversary of our own independence movement should coincide with that of the nation itself. The two revolutions were vastly different in scope, of course, but they were identical in principle. We too memorialize a day of independence, independence from a wardship not unlike that of the American colonists. Until the advent of the National Federation of the blind people of America were taken care of but not represented, protected but not emancipated, seen but rarely heard. Like Patrick Henry, on the eve of revolution, we who are blind knew in 1940 that if we wished to be free, if we meant to gain those inestimable privileges of participation for which we had so long yearned, Then we must organize for purposes of self-expression and collective action. Then we must concert to engage in a noble struggle. In that spirit, the National Federation of the Blind was founded. In that spirit, it has persevered. In that spirit, it will prevail. When the founding fathers of the Federation came together at Wilkes-Barre to form a union, they labored in a climate of skepticism and scorn. The experts said it couldn't be done. The agencies for the blind said it shouldn't be done. But the Federation was born without outside assistance. It stood upright without a helping hand. It is still on its feet today. At the outset, we declared our independence. In the past 25 years, we have established and maintained that independence. Today, we may say that the National Federation has arrived in America and is here to stay. That is truly the new outlook for the blind. Now, we haven't reached our present standing, as all of you know, by inertia and idleness. The long road of our upward movement is divided into three phases corresponding to the first decade, the second decade, and the third half decade of our existence as an organization. Each of these three periods play, although they're all part of a continuum, play a different tune, have a different emphasis, and different character. It is my purpose now to take a short look at each. The Federation was not born with a silver spoon in its mouth, but like the nation itself, it was born with the parchment of its principles in its hands. Our basic philosophy and purposes, even in fact, many, if not most, of our long-range programs existed full panoplied at our origin. We were dedicated to the principles of security with freedom, of opportunity without prejudice, of equality in the law and on the job. We have never needed to alter or modify these goals, let alone compromise them. We have never faltered in our confidence that they are within our reach. We have never failed to labor for their implementation in political, legal, and economic terms. The paramount problems of our first decade, the 1940s, were not so much quantitative as qualitative. We had the philosophy and the programs, but we lacked the membership and the means. The workers were few, and the cupboard was bare. Each month, if I may be personal for a moment, as we received our none too bountiful salaries as a young instructor at the University of Chicago Law School, Hazel and I would distribute it among the necessaries of life: food, clothing, rent, Federation stamps, mimeograph ink, and other supplies. So did we share our one-room apartment. The mimeograph paper took far more space in our closet than did our clothes. We had to move the mimeograph machine before we could let down the wall bed to retire at night. If, on a Sunday, we walked along Chicago's lakefront, and I don't know why anybody would want to do that anymore, for an hour, four or five fewer letters were written, and our output dropped for that day below 25. The decade of the 40s was a time of building. And build we did. From a scattering of seven state affiliates at our first convention to more than four times that number in 1950. It was a time of pioneering, and pioneer we did, by searching out new paths of opportunity and blazing organizational trails where no blind man had put his foot before in America. It was a time of collective self-discovery and self-reliance, of rising confidence in our joint capacity to do the job, to hitch up our own wagon train, and hitch it up we did. In the decade of the 40s, We proved our organizational capacity, established our representative character, initiated legislative programs on the state and national levels, and spoke with the authority and voice of the blind speaking for themselves. In these very terms, the decade of the 50s was a time both of triumph and travail. The triumph was not unmixed, and the travail, fortunately, was passing. Our numbers escalated to a peak of 47 statewide affiliates with membership running in the tens of thousands. Our resources multiplied through a campaign of fundraising. Our voice was amplified with the inauguration of the Braille Monitor as a regular publication in print, Braille, and tape, which carried the word of federationism to the farthest parts of the nation and to many lands of the world. With funds to back us up, with a broad base of membership behind us, with constructive programs of opportunity and enlargement, with growing public recognition and understanding, the Federation in the 50s galvanized its energy along an expanding front. We sent teams of blind experts into various states on request of the governors to prepare master plans for the reform of their welfare services to the blind. We aided our state affiliates in broad programs of legislative and administrative improvement in welfare and rehabilitation. We participated in opening the teaching profession to qualified blind teachers in a number of states. We assisted in bringing to completion the campaign to secure white cane laws in all of the states so that blind persons might walk abroad anywhere in the land, sustained by a faith justified by law. We shared with others the credit for infusing into federal welfare the constructive objectives of self-care and self-support, progressive improvements in the aid grant and matching formula, and the addition of disability insurance. Over the unflagging opposition of the Social Security Administration, we secured the acceptance by Congress of the principle of exempt income for blind aid recipients. At first temporary and finally permanent permission for Pennsylvania and Missouri to retain their separate and rehabilitative systems of public assistance. And we began to lay the groundwork by which our blind workers in the sheltered shops might secure the status and rights of employees. We pushed, pulled, and persuaded the civil service, first to modify, then to relax, and finally to scrap its policy of discrimination against blind applicants for the government service. In these enterprises, as against the doctrinaire aloof resistance of administration, we had the cordial goodwill, the practical understanding, and the humane regard of an ever-growing number of the members of Congress. All of a sudden, in the furious 50s, the NFB was very much noticed. Our organization became the object of intense attention, if rarely of affection, on the part of agencies, administrators, and their satellite groups which had dominated the field before our appearance. As the organized blind movement grew in affluence and influence, as affiliates sprang up in state after state, county after county across the land, as a groundswell of protest rose against the dead end of sheltered employment and segregated training, of welfare programs tied to the poor law and social workers bound up in red tape, the forces of custodialism and control looked down from their lighthouses and began to fight back. The NFB, said its president in 1957, stands today an embattled organization. Our motives have been impugned, our purposes reviled, our integrity aspersed, our representative character denied. Plans have been laid, activities undertaken, and concerted actions set in motion for the clear and unmistakable purpose of bringing about our destruction. Nothing less is sought than our extinction as an organization. No Federationist who lived through that decade can forget how the battle was joined. In the historic struggle of the right of the blind to self-expression and free association, the single most famous piece of legislation our movement has produced, one which was never passed by Congress, but which made its full weight felt and its message known throughout the world of welfare and the country of the blind, was the Kennedy-Baring Bill. It is fitting that John F. Kennedy, then the junior senator from Massachusetts, was a sponsor of that Bill of Rights for the blind, who gave his name and his voice to the defense of our right to organize. 8 years ago, he rose in the Senate to introduce and speak for his bill to protect the right of the blind to self-expression. He told how some 43 associations of blind persons had become federated into a single nationwide organization, the National Federation of the Blind. He declared, "It is important that its views be expressed freely and without interference. It is important that its views be heard and considered by persons charged with responsibility." He pointed out that in various communities, this freedom had been prejudiced by a few professional workers in programs for the blind. He urged that our blind citizens be protected against any exercise of this kind of influence or authority to interfere with their freedom of self-expression through organizations of the blind. The Kennedy-Baring Bill was simple and sweeping in its purposes: to ensure the blind the right to organize without intimidation, and to ensure to the blind the right to speak and to be heard through systematic means of consultation with the responsible agencies of government. That Bill of Rights was not enacted, as I have said, but it gained its ends in other ways. Lengthy and dramatic public hearings were held by a committee of Congress at which dozens of blind witnesses and others, both expert and rank and file, testified to the extent of coercion and pressure brought against them by the forces hostile to their independence. Little Kennedy bills were introduced in a number of states and adopted in two. The forces of opposition called off their attack upon the organized blind and beat a hasty and strategic retreat. Meanwhile, in that second decade, the Federation faced another bitter struggle within its own house. Not all Federationists were happy with the way the movement was going. There were a few who were decidedly soft on custodialism and over-friendly to the agencies which opposed us. There were others with a burning passion for leadership and for office, an ambition which burned the deeper as it burned in vain. There were still others whose grievances were personal, real enough to them, no doubt, if not substantial in fact. All of these factors combined in the 50s to form a temporary crisis of confidence and collaboration. But then, as suddenly as it had begun, the civil turmoil ended. Those who had desired power for their own ends or for itself, who had sought to change the character and officers of the movement, departed to form an organization of their own. Shaken in its unity, depleted in resources, diminished in membership, the Federation began the hard task of rebuilding and rededication. That task has been the primary assignment of the 60s, and today, at the halfway mark, we may report that it has been accomplished. During the 5 years past, we have regained stability, recovered unity, and preserved democracy. We have found new and dynamic leadership in the person of a president imbued with youth and with creative vigor. We have regained our fundraiser, the Wizard of St. Louis. And with him, has come the prospect of renewed resources. We have restored and rejuvenated the Braille Monitor, as not only the voice but the clarion call of federated blind people throughout the land. We have reached across the seas, extending the hand of brothership and the vision of federationism to blind people the world over through the International Federation of the Blind. We have made new friends, yes, and found new champions in the Congress of the United States. And in so doing, we have brightened the vistas of hope and opportunity not only for 500,000 blind Americans, but for all the handicapped and deprived who rely upon their government for a hand up rather than a hand out. And in this new decade of the 60s, we of the Federation are reaching toward another base of understanding and support. We intend to carry our case and our cause not only to the lawmakers in Congress, but to the judges in the courts as well. For it is in their tribunals that new pathways of progress are being cleared as the result of a happily evolving concept which holds that the great principles of the Constitution, among them liberty, dignity, privacy, and equality, must be brought down off of the wall and be made real in the lives of all of our citizens with all deliberate speed. The organized blind have traveled far in the past quarter century. The road ahead will not be easy, but the road is never easy for the blind traveler. Every step is a challenge. Every independent advance is a conquest. The movement of the organized blind in society is like the movement of the blind person in traffic. In both cases, the gain is proportionate to the risk. Let us adventure together. It was Theodore Roosevelt who said that the sign of real strength in a nation that it can speak softly and carry a big stick. The sign of strength in our movement is that we speak vigorously and carry a white cane. Whatever may be the challenges to come, whatever the opposition to be converted or defeated, whatever the problems of maintaining internal democracy and external drive, whatever the difficulties of activating apathetic blind persons and associating successful but indifferent blind persons, whatever the slow progress and temporary setbacks in achieving our ultimate goals, our experience and our accomplishments of a quarter of a century tell us one thing. We can prevail. And we shall prevail. We have prevailed over the limitations of blindness in our own lives and in our movement. We shall prevail over the handicap of blindness in all its forms, not the physical disability, which is an act of nature that may not be repealed, but the social handicap, which is an act of men that men can counteract. We have prevailed in our movement and in our minds over the myth of the helpless blind man. We shall prevail over that myth of helplessness in the minds of all who have sight but no vision. We have prevailed over the foredooming conclusion that the blind are ineducable, that lack of sight means loss of mind, and over the only slightly less foredooming conclusion that the blind can be taught, but only the rudiments of academe and the rudest of crafts. We shall prevail over every arbitrary restriction and exclusion inhibiting the fullest development of mind and skill of every blind person in the land. We have prevailed over the legal stricture that the blind should not mix and mingle with the public in public places, but should confine their movement to the rocking chair. We shall prevail over the lingering concept in the law of torts that the white cane and white cane laws should not be given full credence, and that blind persons are automatically guilty of contributory negligence whenever an accident befalls them. We have prevailed over some of the myriad social discriminations against the blind in hotels, in renting rooms, houses, safety deposit boxes, in traveling alone, in blood banks, in playing at gambling tables, in jury duty and serving as a judge, in purchasing insurance, in release from the penitentiary on parole, in holding student body offices, in marriage laws and customs. We shall prevail over the whole sorry pattern, which is no less vicious because it is based upon the best of motives. We have prevailed over the notion that the blind are capable only of sheltered employment. We shall prevail over the institution of the sheltered workshop itself as a proper place for any blind person capable of competitive employment. We have prevailed against the exclusion of qualified blind workers in a number of fields of competitive employment. We shall prevail over such discrimination in every calling and career. We have prevailed over the principle of welfare aid as a mere palliative for those in distress without built-in incentives to help them out of that distress. We shall prevail over the stubborn remnants of the poor law creed, the means test, the liens pest, the requirements of residence, the concept of relatives' responsibility, wherever they rear their Elizabethan heads in the statutes of the state and the nation. We have prevailed over the obstacles to communication and communion among the blind of America, the physical distances, the psychological differences, the lack of devices for writing and talking, which have isolated us from one another. We shall prevail over the greater obstacles to communication and affiliation among the blind people of the world. We shall carry federationism to all the nations. We have prevailed and we shall prevail because we have demonstrated to the world and to ourselves that the blind possess the strength to stand together and to walk alone, the capacity to speak for themselves and to be heard with respect, the resolute determination of a common purpose and a democratic cause, the faith that can move mountains and can mount movements. Twenty-5 years, a quarter of a century. How much time is that in the perspective of eternity? It is an incalculable and imperceptible fraction. In the chronology of the universe, it is less than an instant. In the eye of God, it is no more than a flash. In the biography of a social movement based on justice and equality, it is a measurable segment. In the life of a man, say, from his 30th to his 55th year. It encompasses the best years, the very prime, when experience, energy, intellect mingle in their most favorable proportions, before which he is too young, and after which, pardon me for saying it, he is too old. As a man who spent those 25 best years of life in and with the Federation, I have few regrets, immense pride, and boundless hope for the future. Thank you very much.